You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast, Updating Outpatient Recommendations in COVID-19 Management, Identifying Opportunities for Risk Reduction in Non-Hospitalized Patients. I'm Deb Gordon, and I'm joined by Dr. Christopher Palma, Assistant Professor of Medicine at the University of Rochester in New York. Today, we'll focus on current guidelines for diagnosing COVID-19 and why people with certain underlying conditions face a higher risk of hospitalization and death if they get infected. Welcome, Dr. Palma.
Thank you.
Can you believe it's been more than 3 years since we woke up to something called COVID?
Yeah, it's been a long road. Thankfully, where we are now in 2023 is substantially better than where we were in early 2020.
Which is perfect for my next question, which is back then we didn't even have reliable tests for the virus. So talk about where we are today and maybe where we're going.
Yeah, I mean, COVID has been remarkable for the rapid pace of development of clinical diagnostics and therapeutics and preventative measures. There's nothing been like this accomplished by medicine and science and industry as rapidly before. So we went from not knowing what the novel virus was to having an entire genome readily accessible within, you know, realistically months of the initial outbreak clinically being identified, to having widespread adoption of clinical therapy or clinical diagnostic tests in advanced laboratories, to at-home tests widely available, produced in, you know, the order of billions of tests within a year. So a truly remarkable pace of development. And then on the therapeutic side, we went from having generally no available therapeutics to repurposing broadly general antivirals to COVID, to repurposing immunosuppressive drugs for our sickest patients with COVID-19, to having highly effective, direct, intentionally designed antivirals that are now widely available. So an incredible rate of development within the last 3 years.
So let's go back to testing and diagnosis. We have two main types of tests, the antigen and then most of us know it as PCR. So talk about these tests and how they should be used and maybe even a little bit about how their use has changed over time. I remember when getting a PCR test was about as challenging as winning the lottery.
Yeah, testing is a really interesting space to think about for the pandemic and a lot to talk about. So we broadly have two test modalities that have differing advantages relative to each other. We have PCR or nucleic acid testing, where we're looking for nucleic acid parts of the viral genome and using an amplification technology, PCR, to detect extremely small amounts of viral nucleic acid, viral RNA. And that, you know, technique has been around since the 80s and has been, prior to the pandemic, adopted by many clinical labs for diagnosing respiratory viral infections, and so was an obvious technology to rapidly develop for testing COVID. Unfortunately, there were some missteps in the development of these tests in the United States, which led to challenges accessing them early on, even though you would think they would be very easy to develop and rapidly roll out. But so that's why, you know, kind of those memories of back in mid-2020, testing was not recommended for most persons. It was kind of restricted. And so that's where that kind of part of the pandemic came from. Those development problems have been fully worked out. These tests are now widely available. They are relatively economical. They have a turnaround time that ranges from, there are point of care devices for nucleic acid testing that can give you a turnaround time, you know, within about an hour. But most clinical labs do it in a highly automated, high throughput, high volume methodology that makes it much more economical, but gives a turnaround time of about a day or two. So I would say that's the biggest drawback currently for nucleic acid testing is that it takes a day or two to get an answer. And that can substantially impact clinical outcomes if you really have a very narrow window to intervene. And that's the case with a lot of our COVID therapeutics, that a delay of a day or two could really make a difference in the efficacy of your treatments. The other drawback is cost. You know, these tests cost on the order of $100 to a few hundred dollars. And then accessing them is more of a challenge because, again, they're really processed mostly in high throughput automated labs. There are really interesting machines, like Cepheid makes a whole array of benchtop machines that you could have in your clinical office in a small clinic and give a turnaround time in 30 to 60 minutes that are really interesting devices and seen a lot of, you know, substantially more adoption in routine clinical practice than before the pandemic. So that's the one end, the nucleic acid testing. The other advent that was really game changing and, you know, a first for COVID was at-home testing using lateral flow assays, which is what we call antigen testing. We're actually testing for protein components of the virus. The advantage here is these tests have a turnaround time of minutes, you know, typically 10 to 15 minutes. And they have been validated for at-home use with specimens collected by average people and not with no medical training. And their test is, you know, phenomenally low, you know, on the orders of a dollar or a few dollars to produce, and commercially available for a handful of dollars. So the advantage there is their rapidity. They are exquisitely specific. It is very uncommon to get a false positive, but they do sacrifice a bit in sensitivity. Again, there's no amplification step here, so it does take more virus to detect. And so they may turn positive, you know, that clinical outcome may be that they may be positive later into the disease course than a nucleic acid test.
So that's why there's the recommendation to do serial testing. It's not a once and forget it.
Yeah. So, you know, in a scenario where you think the prior probability of disease is very high and you were to unexpectedly get a negative test, there's a few reasons for that. One is the patient or does not have the disease. They don't have COVID. That's one possibility. But if you think it's really highly likely that they do, there's a few other scenarios to think about. One would be that we are testing too early in the disease course, especially for antigen-based testing, the home testing, that if you're obtaining a nasal swab very early in the course, maybe there's just not enough viral protein there to detect. And something like a nucleic acid test a PCR test would have detected the infection earlier. So again, a way to overcome that is to wait a day or two and test again. And again, the additive sensitivity of multiple tests improves. So if you test again a day or two later, you improve your sensitivity, the likelihood you're going to pick up an actual infection.
And we have new tests coming. I just recently read about the approval of a combined flu COVID test.
Yeah, this is kind of the long-term fruits of all this investment in research and development for COVID, is that hopefully we can adapt these technologies and what we've learned to other respiratory viral infections. And so we're seeing the first approval for home antigen tests for influenza and likely for RSV in the near term as well. And, you know, the reason these multi-tests are interesting is because, you know, it's important to discriminate between respiratory viral infections because we have therapeutics that are effective for some. We have some respiratory viruses where we don't have really very effective therapeutics, and we have some where there are intermediate therapeutics, and they don't work across different viruses necessarily. So getting an actual diagnosis for the pathogen becomes very important all of a sudden for therapeutics. And so in the past, you know, we've said you have symptoms of a viral respiratory infection, you know, rest, have some tea, because we don't have any therapeutics to offer. We're in a different scenario now. We have, you know, some highly effective therapeutics for individual respiratory viral infections. And all of a sudden, it's very important to actually make an accurate clinical diagnosis for the first time. And so I think we'll see many of these at-home tests develop over the coming years. And I think we'll see, you know, also the role for nucleic acid testing is going to be there too, for going into a clinic, an urgent care, an emergency department, obtaining an accurate diagnosis, you know, will dramatically impact therapeutic choice, care, and outcome.
One last question on testing. There's a nasal test being investigated. Can you talk a little bit about that?
There's other testing modalities that are not yet approved, and they include being able to make a diagnostic decision and an accurate diagnosis based on either respiratory exhalations, either from the mouth or through the nose, or through volatile organic compounds. So there's multiple studies for those. They are not yet approved, but they may become available down the road.
What are some of the current unmet needs you see clinically when it comes to diagnosing COVID-19?
Overall, diagnostics have gotten substantially better. I think we're going to see that change in the coming months as the supplies for federally purchased tests kind of eventually run out. And so then the question becomes, who pays for testing and in what scenario? And I think that's going to be the challenge in the middle term, in the near term, is kind of just like all of medical care, having it be paid for and be affordable in the United States is going to be a challenge. So for the moment, though, there's still widespread access to free antigen tests or very economically priced antigen tests. And insurance is certainly covering it for patients that have commercial insurance or state-funded insurance like Medicare.
Now let's move on to high-risk patients. What do we mean by high-risk?
Yeah, so high-risk has probably changed realistically over time. We're talking about who is at high risk for poor outcomes if they develop COVID-19, if they have an infection, meaning that they wind up hospitalized in the intensive care unit or wind up suffering and dying from COVID-19 ultimately. So that population has changed dramatically over time, both as we have developed successful interventions to reduce risk for poor outcomes, and both as people's own internal risks have changed over time with the advent of things like vaccination or prior infections, which, you know, have substantially improved population-wide immunity and reduced everybody's overall risk. So that risk pool for people at really severe risk for poor outcomes has substantially declined from where we started. So that population is much smaller than where it was. Unfortunately, though, there are people that still remain at substantially high risk for hospitalization or death from COVID-19. And those are people that are not well protected by efforts in nature to improve immunity. So those are patients who have less functional or non-functional immune systems, essentially. And so those fall into really broad categories. One that I think of the most is age. Unfortunately, with age, our immune system ages as well. And there's this phenomenon of immunosenescence, where your ability to respond to infections, especially new infections, decreases substantially with age. And so really in the 7th and 8th decile of life and beyond, your ability to be protected by a vaccine or a prior infection is substantially less than everybody else in the population. And we've seen that play out, across the entire time frame of the last 3 years. These people always were at extremely high risk, and unfortunately, they essentially remain really at high risk, despite everybody else's risk going down because of things like vaccinations and prior infections. So there's that population, and that's a large population, especially in the United States, of people in their 70s, 80s, and 90s. The other class are people who have non-functional immune systems, either because of inborn errors where they don't have functioning immune systems, or due to medical interventions for other diseases that substantially decrease the efficacy of their immune system, their immunoprotection. So broad categories of that, the biggest population is going to be people receiving substantial doses of chemotherapy, especially myeloablative chemotherapy that's targeting lymphocytes, immune cells. So those would be our patients with things like lymphoma or leukemia, as well as very common diseases that are kind of not quite lymphoma or leukemia, like CLL, chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And those populations are very large. You're talking about, on the order of combined millions of people in the United States. And so anybody who's had a bone marrow transplant would also fall into that category. And so those patients really have very poorly functioning immune systems, often for a long time afterwards. There are all of our patients who have chronic immunosuppressive drugs they take, especially those targeting the cells that make antibodies that respond to vaccines and protect us. So those would be people receiving B-cell depleting therapies. There are very, very large populations in the United States of people with diseases like multiple sclerosis, lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, that receive these drugs on a very regular schedule. And just like other diseases in the past, they have a substantially increased risk of poor outcomes. And we've known this from influenza and other diseases, and it's the same for COVID-19. Unfortunately, they are much less well protected from vaccination. And then there, our last category are people with kind of defects in their immune system from birth. That's a much smaller population. These are people with SCID, severe combined immunodeficiency, or chronic variable immunodeficiency, CVID. And these patients are often already on some form of treatment for reducing their risks of infection, like receiving immunoglobulin transfusions. And we would hope that at this point, those transfusions contain protective antibodies, but we still worry about those patients quite a bit.
So we used to have, there used to be a way to sort of prophylactically protect people, high-risk people. We no longer have that option.
Yeah, so just like we give our patients with combined variable immunodeficiency immunoglobulin infusions, we were doing that for COVID with specific COVID antibodies where they were produced by pharmaceutical companies. And so those products, unfortunately, there was one product licensed earlier in the pandemic that seemed very effective. Unfortunately, with newer variants of the virus currently, it's predicted that that drug would have no efficacy, and so it's been withdrawn from the market. And so that's not available anymore. That may change. There's hopes that there will be new products made available that cover current circulating variants. But at the moment, that's a big gap in our therapeutic armamentarium, or all of our, bag of tricks we can use to try and reduce risk. And unfortunately, that doesn't exist at the moment.
So really, these populations need to continue being relatively isolating, wearing a mask.
Well, it's been a long time. It's hard to tell people to isolate for 3+ years. The other way I would view of risk mitigation is we have very effective therapeutics. And so if we can't protect you by vaccination, if instead we want you to be able to, get out into society and participate and enjoy life, another risk mitigation procedure would be therapeutic options if you do get sick. And so that, I think that's where these populations, fall now, is that we try and focus our interventions on them who really stand the most to benefit from treatment for COVID-19. And so these are populations that if they have upper respiratory infections, they really do, it's really in their benefit to test them and identify what is the culprit of their cough and runny nose. And if it is COVID-19 and we think they really are substantial risk because we think their immune system's non-functional or they're older, those are the patients we should really be trying to offer therapeutic interventions to as soon as possible.
Great. And that's going to be the topic of the next podcast in this series. For now, though, we have run out of time for today's podcast. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak about the diagnosis of COVID-19 and how the disease manifests in high-risk patients. And I want to thank our listeners for joining us. We hope you'll listen to the next episode from this series. This podcast was brought to you by Med Learning Group. Med Learning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I also want to give a special thank you to our supporter, Pfizer, who provided an educational grant for this activity.